After over a year of U.S. war and occupation in Iraq, the Bush administration continues to try to justify the invasion. At the same time, a congressional committee has released a report condemning Bush and his cabinet for the dozens of misleading statements and outright lies they used to push for war in Iraq. The debate continues to rage in the halls of Washington, while the people of Iraq remain under occupation. Are the people of Iraq, particularly women, better off without Saddam Hussein? Are the rights of women a priority for the U.S. occupying forces? I spoke with a number of women representing Iraqi and international organizations that work with women in Iraq to ask them these questions. The overwhelming response among all the groups was that women are worse off now than they were even under Saddam Hussein. Farida Deif is the Mideast North Africa Program Director for Human Rights Watch.
Well, obviously, I mean, in terms of in the Middle East and North Africa, there are few countries that are in a state of armed conflict, and so Iraq would be one of them. And obviously, this creates an added burden on women, and oftentimes women in conflict suffer the most. So obviously, in that sense, women in Iraq are at a disadvantage. But in terms of other rights, for example, in the family or in discrimination that goes on or violence, whether it be by the state or in domestic situations, I really couldn't point to one country that's worse off than another, but it certainly is a general climate that's discriminatory towards women throughout the region. Well, it's certainly been very difficult for women, particularly right after the war, because all of the sort of the legal system collapsed, and there was a sort of sense of anarchy in on the streets. And so obviously this created a very vulnerable situation for many women and as well as girls. So it seems that things, at least on the surface, have changed a little bit. There seems to be some sort of, you know, move towards creating viable institutions and more security on the street. But it's really unclear whether or not or how this has affected women. Obviously, I mean, in the report that was done, we discussed the fact that because of this general state of insecurity, many women have been driven indoors, have stayed in the home just simply because of the general state of insecurity and the risk of sexual and other physical violence on the street. So it's not really clear to us whether the situation outside of the home has, whether it's changed, and or whether there are less cases of rape and sexual violence simply because less women are going outdoors in certain times, out in the evenings and so on.
Medea Benjamin works with Code Pink, a U.S. women's peace organization that has been sending delegations to Iraq.
It's been devastating for women. Women had already suffered through the war in Iran in the 80s, the war with Kuwait. There are hundreds of thousands of Iraqi women who were widows trying to take care of their families alone. On top of that, they suffered the devastating effects of sanctions and, of course, the brutality of the regime of Saddam Hussein. Given all that, they were ready and really deserved a break. And what's happened is that things are even worse for them. With the occupation and the war came more death, more suffering, more destruction, devastation of infrastructure that's made the water contaminated, the phone system not working, the electricity still intermittent. On top of that, tremendous unemployment and tremendous insecurity with the chaos that followed the dissolving of the Iraqi police force after the U.S. invasion. So, and then adding to that entire equation is the fact that under the occupation, the more conservative clerics have gained significant power, and that bodes very ill for the gains that Iraqi women have made in the last 100 years that are quite impressive and unrivaled in the rest of the Middle East.
Huzan Mahmoud represents the Organization for Women's Freedom in Iraq, an organization formed last year when the occupation began, with hundreds and now thousands of Iraqi women as members.
Well, you can see all different examples coming out from Iraq, and that doesn't mean that this is the majority. I mean, you can see these women, and particularly they bring some Islamic women, I mean, who are veiled to speak on behalf of Iraqi women and generalizing their ideas. while they are marginalizing the progressive secular women in Iraq, for example, which is not good. I mean, people should be equally given the chance to give their opinions. For example, I always find that, you know, this government, I mean, even the Western media, is much more interested in generalizing the ideas of backward reactionary women rather than progressive secular women, which is not correct, because in Iraq, women were highly educated, they were secular people, and they were not wearing veil. I mean, there were some women who were wearing veil as a matter of choice, but really now, it's all being imposed on them, because if you are not veiled, you are not respected. That's what the Islamic groups were doing and writing on the walls of the schools, to basically break the girls' personalities, you know? So if someone comes out and says, oh, I'm free to talk now, it's really not something generalizing the whole situation in Iraq. I mean, you can't really generalize this kind of thing. But whereas there are other women feminist newspapers that are telling exactly opposite, that actually they are being imprisoned now because they lost their jobs, and plus they are being veiled. So what kind of freedom is this?
Unlike Afghanistan, freedom of religion, including Christianity, was allowed in Iraq, even under the tyrannical force of Saddam Hussein. The 1954 Constitution was a highly secular document, and it was only in the 1990s, after the devastation of the first Gulf War and the continued sanctions, that the dictatorship became more brutal and extreme in its policies toward women. Phyllis Bennis is a researcher with the Institute for Policy Studies.
The reality is that Iraq historically was one of the two most secular Arab countries, and Islamism in its current form, as it's on the rise now, was never a major factor in Iraqi politics. This is all pretty new. This is all the result of the desperation that people felt after the war because of the sanctions, the desperation that a once wealthy, powerful country with an educated, healthy population was suddenly brought to destitution. And it led, inevitably, as it does in so many other places, people turn to religion for solace when they can't get anything else. And that's what's led to this kind of challenge. Women in Iraqi society over the last 30, 40 years were among the most advanced of anywhere in the Arab world. Of course, they faced very much the same kind of political repression under Saddam Hussein's regime that men did. And as we know, women were in very high positions within the Ba'ath Party and within the organs of repression themselves, included many women. But in terms of basic education, literacy, access to health care, in all those key arenas, Iraqi women were better off than the women in almost any other Arab country. So this is a very new phenomenon, and what it's going to take to fight back is going to be very, very difficult.
The U.S.-appointed Governing Council voted in January to install Islam as the official religion of Iraq, thereby canceling family civil laws and placing such issues under the jurisdiction of a strict Islamic legal code known as Sharia. This move, called Resolution 137, was vetoed at the last minute by the U.S. Ambassador Paul Bremer. But many Iraqi women fear that the Governing Council, dominated by extremist religious leaders, will continue their push for implementing Islamic Sharia law in Iraq. Sara Hassanagi, a researcher with the Feminist Majority, comments on what Resolution 137 would have meant for Iraqi women.
It would have meant that women's rights would have been, like family laws such as child custody and inheritance, rights of divorce, even the marriage age of women could have been left up to the various Islamic schools of thought. So regarding marriage age, for example, under the civil code, the current Iraqi civil code, the marriage age was 18, but under different various interpretations of Islam, it could have been lowered to as much as 9 years old. So women would have definitely lost their rights if Resolution 137 was voted on. There were protests. The Iraqi women really took it in their own hands and pushed very hard to get that overturned. It was, you know, the Iraqi women who basically got it overturned. The Iraqi Governing Council did meet, and many of the women came when they were voting on the resolution. And actually, when the women came to, I don't know how many, I think it was six or seven of the Shia clerics, actually, I'm not clerics, sorry, Governing Council members walked out of the meeting, but they still won. I think the vote was 15 to 10. But there is still fear, you know, when the sovereignty is handed back over to the Iraq, to Iraq in June, which is what the U.S. is proposing, that the people in power could reinstate Resolution 137 or something like it. And I know they had thousands of signatures on a petition pushing for 40% of seats in the National Assembly to be women. And while they did not win 40%, they did win 25%. And there is still a question, actually, about that 25%, because the way that it's written, you can't tell if it's a quota or if it's a target. And so I think the women's groups there are definitely going to be pushing that it is a quota and to push for more in the permanent constitution that will be written in the next year or two. So,
Huzn Mahmoud with the Organization for Women's Freedom in Iraq.
Talking about ruling council and what it offers to women, it is useless because of their nature, because of the moves they made. I mean, the first thing they did last year was to change 8th of March and change it to 18th of August, the date of birth of Prophet Muhammad's daughter, Fatima Zahra. I mean, it's just a pure Islamization of Iraqi society, nothing else. Or they recently they tried to push for Resolution 137, which is to replace the personal status law with Islamic Sharia law. I mean, these are all the things that they were offering. This is the best that they could offer to Iraqi women, which is basically enslavement and violating their rights on a very large scale. So they do not really offer any hope for Iraqi women. And we see the whole issue of this ruling government, ruling council, and the people that are in that council are all being handpicked by America. So basically whoever is the president of that ruling council certainly is not representing the Iraqi people. He or she, in most of the cases, is he. It's a highly patriarchal council, and he will be just serving America's interests, and it's a puppet. So we do not recognize or legitimize this kind of people at all.
Farida Deef is the Mideast North Africa Program Director for Human Rights Watch. She explains what the imposition of Sharia law in the area of family law has meant for women in other areas where it has been put in place.
There's obviously a lot of discrimination that takes place in the family law in particular. For example, in many of the countries in the region, women who are battered in the home or have suffered from domestic violence find it very difficult to be granted a divorce, although in practice, in some countries, they can initiate a divorce. In other countries, they cannot without proving some sort of harm, and this harm is often very difficult to prove. Medical records in terms of domestic violence are often not good enough. The courts will often require an eyewitness to abuse, and so this creates a very difficult situation for women and keeps many women in very battered situations. In terms of other laws in the region which have been discriminatory towards women and can potentially be so in Iraq as well. For example, in many countries, the women cannot transfer citizenship to their children if they marry non-nationals. Now, obviously, this has a direct implication in terms of women's status in the state, women's status as a citizen of the state. It seems that in many of the countries, women have a very indirect relationship to the state. It's sort of mediated by a male counterpart, and so, in a sense, women themselves cannot transfer citizenship, are not seen as full citizens. It's only through a man that citizenship can be transferred. The Iraqi constitution, for example, the draft that we've seen, explicitly talks about the fact that citizenship cannot be withdrawn by the government, cannot be denied, but it's silent on the way that citizenship is transferred. And this is very problematic because oftentimes it's been interpreted as a male prerogative and women have been denied the right to transfer citizenship to their children.
While the interim constitution, approved in early February by the governing council in Iraq, does make concessions to women's demands for equal representation in the government, some women feel that it does not go far enough. Medea Benjamin, whose organization Code Pink works with women on the ground in Iraq.
Well, the new interim constitution calls for an effort to have women be 25% of the National Assembly that will be formed. This is because women in Iraq and their allies around the world have been pressuring for some kind of representation that is significant for women. Women in Iraq, because of all the wars, represent actually over 50% of the population. The problem with the way that it is worded is that it is a target and not a quota, which means it does not have to be complied with. It also only refers to the interim assembly and not all of the appointed positions that are so critical, the governorships, the ministries, the cabinet positions. So it is a partial gain for women, but I certainly wouldn't call it a tremendous victory, especially because we don't know yet if it will even be implemented.
Even if the new Iraqi government were to have full, equal representation of men and women, which it seems unlikely to even come close to, many Iraqis still would not consider it a legitimate governing body because it was imposed upon them by an occupying military force, the United States Army. Medea Benjamin.
Well, there are women we work with that have refused to engage in this process at all, even pushing for more representation of women because they consider the U.S. occupying forces to be illegal and illegitimate, and they don't want to give any credence to what the occupying forces are doing. So you get a very lopsided group of women who will participate right now. Some of the best and the brightest refuse to be involved in this process, and that is a tremendous loss for Iraqi women. It also means that the women who will be chosen in the next phase are women who do give legitimacy to the occupation, and that does not represent a broad spectrum of Iraqis, and bodes will ill for a broader representation in the future.
Sada Powell, the administrative director of the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs, thinks it's unlikely that Iraqis will accept the interim constitution at all.
I don't think that you can come in as an outsider, as the U.S. has done, and impose numbers and laws and an entire constitution based on very little cultural and historical knowledge of the region, collusion with elites who haven't lived in the country for decades and who are, to my view, looking out for their own interests rather than the interests of their countrymen. Rights aren't going to be guaranteed under a constitution that guarantees rights if the constitution fails.
Huzan Mahmoud, with the Organization for Women's Freedom in Iraq.
The ruling council see itself as a legitimate power, and they see themselves to do anything. But the fact is, and the reality is, that Iraqi people do not recognize them. I mean, the majority of Iraqi people, in particular women, because this ruling council has nothing to do with women's rights, and they are not going to do anything to improve the lives of women in Iraq. And having this constitution, as I said in previously, that you know, ruling council is a creation of is a created government of America, of the United States, and really it's not been elected or chosen by people. So how come they have legitimacy while people would not vote for them? So looking at the whole process, it's just everything is being done, it's being decided over the will of people and against their will and against their wish, basically. I am from Iraq, and I do not recognize government, and I do not recognize their constitution, and I will be fighting against it because I want Iraqi people, the secular, the progressive forces, to have a say in the future politics of Iraq, not to be excluded, not to be... We don't want people come and impose a government on us because Iraqi people do not want this kind of reactionary governments, because we all know that they have decided this, divided our society on the basis of ethnicity, religious sects, and the, you know, all these tribal leaders and stuff like that, which is not giving a human identity to Iraq. It is giving it, it is dividing it and localizing people, which is not for the benefit of Iraqi people at all.
Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies claims that according to international law, the U.S. as an occupying military power has no jurisdiction to implement a constitution, particularly a constitution that separates Iraqis into ethnic groups. Phyllis Bennis.
The problem is that anything that is put in place by the United States lacks legitimacy. It may be numerically accurate in its count of how many Sunnis should there be, and how many Shia, and how many Kurds, and how many Assyrians, and how many Chaldeans, but that doesn't mean it's legitimate. It doesn't mean that it's actually the basis on which Iraqis want their government to function. Do Iraqis want their government to be created on the basis of sectarian divisions? It's possible some do, but it's very likely that some don't, and their voices are not being heard. So I think it's absolutely right that the empowerment of Iraqi women is not going to come from a U.S.-imposed constitution or a U.S.-imposed law that says that women should have 35% of the vote. That's a very nice goal to set, but not if it doesn't come out of Iraqi society fighting for it themselves. If it's imposed from above, it's going to mean very little. I think the U.S. is catering to a wide range of forces who they see as key to maintaining their occupation. It includes some of the religious forces, not generally the most fundamentalist, but people like Ahmed Chalabi, who has linked himself with more religious forces, identifying suddenly as a Shia, although he's very much a secular individual, a secular criminal, we might say, given his history, given the fact that he's wanted in Jordan to serve a lifetime sentence for corruption and bringing down the Petra Bank in Jordan. And he was very much the Pentagon's guy in Iraq. He, in recent weeks, has allied himself with the Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, who is probably the most credible political actor in Iraq today in terms of his support. And Chalabi, who has virtually no support, who spent the last 45 years, actually, I think, outside of Iraq, has no base, no base of support, no credibility, no legitimacy. All he has is his access to power derivative from his ties with the United States. So to gain that kind of local support, he's allying himself with those in the governing council who, for example, are calling or were calling for Islam to play a greater role in the legal determinations of the future constitution.
Despite U.S. pressure and the violence of the occupation, grassroots groups are emerging to stand up for women's rights in Iraq. Phyllis Bennis.
I think there is a civil society movement emerging in Iraq of women, a host of different kinds of constituencies and different kinds of organizations, student groups, women's groups, political groups, the Union of the Unemployed that has emerged, all of which are challenging the occupation, demanding what was promised with the occupation. The U.S. didn't just say, we're going to come and occupy your country. They said, we're going to make you free, we're going to make you rich, we're going to return your country to you. None of that has happened. So I think that there is a growing mobilization like that. I imagine that it's very hard for them to get a voice in the face of the much more visceral and visible component of the occupation, of the resistance, which is the military resistance. That's always going to have a louder voice than civil society.
Mm-hmm. On March 8th, 2004, International Women's Day, just before the one-year anniversary of the invasion, 1,000 women marched through the streets of Baghdad demanding women's rights. Huzan Mahmoud.
You know, I will tell you an example. Recently, in 8th of March, Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq organized a very large demonstration. More than 1,000 people, mainly women, came to the street to Al-Firdaus Square in Baghdad, and they gathered and they were demonstrating, although they were veiled, but, you know, they were calling for separation of religion from the state and education system, as well as calling for secular constitution based upon full equality between men and women. And these women were shouting slogans that 8th of March will be celebrated in Iraq as Women's Day, because women's movement in Iraq is part of the universal movement for equality and freedom. So this was a really, really great message to the ruling council while they were trying to sign a new constitution. But these women and men outside were saying these really brilliant, radical, you know, slogans that in that lack of security and everything, the people still come out and say what they want. And particularly looking at the transportation or money and all that, I mean, people are really not able to go from one area to another area because of lack of money, lack of transportation and everything. But despite that, I mean, 1,000 people is really a lot. I mean, I am in London. I never saw 1,000 people to come out for 8th of March, although there aren't this kind of problems, you know.
But what I'm saying in Iraq, I mean, women, even under the veil, under this black veil, they don't want it. They just want secularism in Iraq. And that is a really brilliant message for 8th of March to give to the ruling council. I mean, you know, Mohammed, she's the head of our organizations. She is being threatened twice by the Islamists for being leading this movement. And we have many, many women organized in Iraq, and they are fighting for their rights. So the movement is growing, and it needs lots of international support, and that's what the representatives abroad are doing. For example, myself, I'm trying to gather political, financial, as well as moral support for the movement inside Iraq and try to link it to the universal movement for women's rights and equality. So that's a major task for us to do as well.
With the growing civil society movement and increasing international opposition to the U.S. occupation of Iraq, the supposed transfer of power scheduled to take place on June 30th may not go as smoothly as the Bush administration hopes. Phyllis Bennis.
There is no transfer of power planned on June 30th. What is planned is the handover of formal authority to some as yet unknown body, most likely the Governing Council itself, perhaps a slightly expanded version of the Governing Council. I have no doubt that something will happen on June 30th that will be called a transition. It will be called a handover of power. Who knows what it'll be called? But what is not going to happen is that power is not going to be returned to the people of Iraq. The U.S. occupation of Iraq is not going to end on June 30th. The U.S. occupation is illegal, and I think that our call must be to end the occupation and then for the UN, the United Nations, to go in, backed by the Arab League and the Organization of the Islamic Conference, the two key regional organizations, with peacekeepers, police officials, security officials, election officials, to help the Iraqis reclaim their sovereignty and reclaim their country. That's not going to guarantee an equal voice for women. That's not by itself going to guarantee that those who are currently without access to power are going to have power. But it will be a start in allowing Iraqis some control over their own country. I think the broader question of how to make sure that women are in front, in charge, is a huge cultural shift that certainly has not taken place in the United States. It's probably pretty unrealistic to think it's going to take place anytime soon in Iraq. The goal must be to ensure that women are at least equally represented as the struggle for democratization and expansion of power within Iraqi society takes place, that women remain central to that process.
Sara Powell, of the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs.
Well, I don't think the U.S. has any right whatsoever to be any part of any transition. As far as I'm concerned, it was an illegal war. It's an illegal occupation. All they can do is pull out in full and immediately and pay reparations, and I think that's what should be done.
Reporting for Wings, I'm Jenka Soderberg.